Hello, and welcome to Ben Yo Chats. If you're curious about the world, this show is for you. What is it like to build a £30 million sustainable business from scratch? On this episode, I speak to Carl Saxton Pitsey. Carl founded sustainable wholesale grocery company Wholegood in 2007. We talk about his entrepreneur journey, the importance of mental health, having sustainability at the heart of a company, and the challenges of running a business. Hope you enjoyed the show. Please like and subscribe, as it helps others find the podcast. Thank you. Be well. Hey, everyone. I'm super excited to be speaking to Carl. Carl was an acting star before founding a sustainable grocery delivery company in 2007 called Wholegood. Wholegood is now on track for £30 million in annual revenue, employs around 160 people, something like that, and is growing really well. So that's one amazing journey. Welcome, Carl.
Thanks, Ben.
So what do you wish you had known back in 2007? There's probably more than one thing, but maybe what's the biggest thing you'd wished on your kind of entrepreneur journey?
I wish that I'd been more open to... I wish I'd been aware of how important management and people are to one's business. Because I can remember a wonderful friend of mine, Jeff, who kindly built this business plan for me. And I remember speaking about management and just kind of saying, well, it's okay, that line can stay the same because it'll just be me. And then and it just kind of, you know, just had this plan that just ramped up, and all the time it was, yeah, just me. You know, I completely underestimated the skill and the time. All I really knew was how to work really hard. So probably that is what I wish I knew, because I just did things in a spit and sawdust, work all night, you know, strategic vision, but just mine, and not sharing that, and just sure that hard work in a kind of, you know, in a way that my dad would have worked, like, you know, as a bricklayer, just every day hammering away, that would give, that would create everything that I needed. And obviously, here we are, 160 people in the business at 30 million.
And you can't do everything yourself.
And I definitely cannot do everything myself. To the point that now that I've got a CEO running the business, I can even just see what I didn't do as CEO. That's been the biggest learning experience for me now, is that I knew that it wasn't, that I knew that I didn't want to be CEO, but seeing what a CEO does is completely different to the way that I was CEO.
That's interesting. I think in business, particularly in small business, there is a lot of talk about founder CEOs, CEOs who come in, and this. And I just reflect, when you talk about what you wish you'd known in 2007, I don't know whether they can teach you that. I think about, you know, what can they teach you at school? And there's a lot of stuff they don't really teach you. And you can learn some stuff from your parents, like, you know, hard work and things like that. But they can't really teach you, like, well, if you manage 100 people, you're not going to be the only one. Or what is management and how do you get the most of people?
Yeah, it's so unique for every business that there is absolutely no secret sauce, in my opinion, other than bucket loads of capital. But then on another level, that doesn't always create something meaningful. It just creates something that can burn money.
Yeah.
And I think that you just... there is just no way of knowing exactly what you need, but you just have to be open to learning about what you need and open to the fact that you're going to make a lot of mistakes. You're just going to make thousands of mistakes. But the most important thing is to make sure that you're always making decisions.
Yeah.
And procrastination is kind of what kills it, right?
Okay. So quick decisions. A new mistake. So try not to make the same mistakes.
Absolutely. But just be open to the fact that every day, especially in the kind of business that Wholegood is, you know, we are heavy supply chain, you know, and that is obviously challenging. because stuff just goes wrong.
Yeah. So thinking back to the early start of your journey, you'd been very successful as an actor. Do you think acting taught you anything?
I've been successful. I don't know. Very successful feels like.
Okay.
But yeah, it was my career, wasn't it? Yeah. So yeah.
Because I guess it's a joke that people say, oh, well, you know, actors and entertainers don't really learn anything else useful for business. But I don't know whether that's true. Do you think because you have storytelling skills, you have communication skills,
yeah,
you
absolutely.
Have hard work? And
I definitely feel like that your business on so many levels is storytelling, especially if you're selling. I mean, how can you not learn as an actor? You know, you essentially learn to play all these different parts. You are always pretending to be somebody else, and actually when you're meeting customers and or if you're raising money or no matter who you're talking to, you're always having to tell your story slightly differently because you need to be able to understand almost what that person is going to get. So you've got to kind of manipulate your story to make sure that the people that you're speaking to understands it. And being an actor completely got me ready for business. You know, to the point that even, you know, we used to have classes on how to shake hands.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, not firm enough. Then. That was a bit too firm. You know, and you'd be there like, you know, 11. How was that?
Yeah.
You know, we had.
You've got to show me the perfect business shake
later on. And then
was this Sylvia Young?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, and I started Sylvia Young when I was 7 and went to Sylvia's full-time school when I was 9, and that completely changed my life, and that absolutely made me definitely, there's no doubt that I probably would have had reasonably good instincts for business. I kind of feel like I always had that, but theatre school teaches you a lot of tricks. You know, and you would on an audition have to go in and hope that somebody likes you within 30 seconds. And you know, you've kind of only got 3 or 4 minutes to get the job. And that you need that in business. You can't go in and just start saying, oh, you know, well, this is my plan. And, you know, just kind of take up 45 minutes of somebody's time. You're going to bore them to death. You've got to know how to go in and perform for that moment. And I just see so many similarities with business and acting. It's just really, really similar. I mean, without wanting to sort of undermine it too much, it is just like, you know, there is a real art to quite a lot of bullshit. You know, you've just got to know how to bullshit your way through things.
Well, I guess that's what selling is, because you're selling dreams, stories, all of those type of things, as well as real stuff.
Because when I first started the business, I would sell, you know, there would be every aspect of the business that I would be selling didn't really exist at that point. Yeah. You know, it didn't. And also, you know, half the time the product didn't exist. Yeah. You know, I'd be selling it and then trying to get it in time from France or Spain or wherever.
But I guess it's the other half is that you knew you could get it, or you were like, I'm sure I will get it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. It definitely wasn't complete bullshit.
Yeah.
It was just part bullshit.
Yeah.
But you know, if you look at some of the stories that business tell, and you look at kind of what people are raising money on, you know, I feel like there was quite a lot of integrity in.
Yeah.
Well,
I guess that feels like the other half, because you mentioned it with your dad as a bricklayer and your mum working hard as well, because you promise someone something and then you have to deliver, and you're going to constantly deliver, and that is actually a working hard aspect. Is that something you had an instinct for, or had from your parents and family? Or
yeah, I can't let people down. Yeah. I mean, that is definitely ingrained in the spirit of Holgood. Absolutely. If we promise a customer something, we will do everything that we can to deliver. That has been easier said than done during the pandemic. But during the pandemic, you know, we doubled in size, we doubled in people, and we definitely, definitely put double the amount of work into the business.
And that comes from you, kind of as the leaders, like, well, you're doing everything. And then this is where I think people think about that founder or that CEO founder as driving the heart and soul of a business.
Yeah, but you know what? You don't really I can completely recognize that now, but a couple of years ago I wouldn't have. And I can recognize that now because we employ so many more people now that you can definitely see that there is a determination and a spirit in the business that definitely does come from me owning it. But then also what you do tend to do is you start to attract, or people that potentially aren't like that might tend to leave or fall away. So actually you start to attract a certain culture. I think that sometimes historically the failure of that has been that I've tried to work people too hard.
Yeah.
Because I work too hard, or I did work too hard.
Interesting you said that, because that's a little bit with, not saying we're as big as him, but Elon Musk has that. He says, I work people really hard, but I expect I will work harder myself. It's just if you're working 20 hours and sleeping on the factory floor, that is not what a typical person is going to do, which is what Musk ended up doing for a lot of time, and therefore burns people out, right? Because no normal person can do that.
I mean, I feel that like all of that resonates in a completely different universe, you know, because that doesn't, maybe I did that, but I did it for like 300 billion less, you know? It definitely feels like as the staff number, as the people increase, actually then what you can do is there's a spirit to what you're doing and there's an energy to what you're doing, but actually then you need to start creating a mechanism underneath it that supports people and that looks after people. And I definitely feel like our new CEO, Martin Sandler, like really has that skill. He understands what looking after people looks like while making it very clear maybe what the business expects.
Accountability.
Yeah, absolutely.
That makes me reflect kind of almost going up that level. What do you think the story of Holger is? So when I've seen it, I've thought of it as having sustainability at its heart, which I always thought was really interesting. This idea that you don't let the customer down. You've got great products, sustainable, and you deliver. And I guess that was kind of its thinking from the start, but maybe you'd say, what was your story? What would you say to people? What would you say to people now?
Sustainability was at the core of why I started it. I started selling organic food because, I mean, it's changed a lot over the past few years in terms of what is available in fresh produce. But they were real polar opposites at the time. There was just conventional and organic, and you know, I chose organic because of the fact that I was a big fan of eating like that. And I think that that's why sometimes it's important to be in a business that you do deeply care about the product that you're selling. It makes it a lot easier. So absolutely, sustainability has always been at the core. I suppose though that what's changed so much is that sustainability made us quite niche, but of course sustainability is now mainstream, right? And the products that we sell are mainstream. And you know, we were pre-packing organic fruit and vegetables in 2010 in organic cotton net for no other reason than I thought it was the right thing to do and I wanted to not use plastic. Now we're in this phase where we're obsessed with taking plastic out of the supply chain. Not always for the right, you know, sometimes I think there's a place for plastic. Mm. But
because it can help lengthen the life of fruit and veg, you get less wastage, right?
Absolutely. But the problem is that, you know, there's no really good infrastructure in this in the UK necessarily to cope with the recycling of it, or there's too many different plastics in the supply chain. But it was definitely, you know, when we started to pack fresh produce in plastic-free packaging and we looked at, you know, we really, really started to push it from 2017. We're still one of the few companies that use the type of packaging that we use in the UK. It's just incredible that big multiples are still not doing it. And it can only be about price. I mean, it really is, because it's bloody expensive to do it. But again, we've always put that sustainability first and then had to kind of unwind, well, how are we going to make money out of this? How are we actually going to make a profit?
Well, you say it's just price, but the other thing I reflect on that is vision. You did it earlier and you did it for purpose and the right thing. Yeah, and it makes money still, but the bit which comes first is vision. So I actually would put that as visionary, maybe not like putting a car on the moon or whatever it is that
yeah,
Elon's
yeah,
done.
Like visionary but... while being completely skinned. Yeah. yeah, like a really nice thing to do for everybody but yourself. Yeah, because it didn't add, you know, we didn't have ways of applying labels to the net and stuff. So, you know, we used to spend hours and hours sort of sticking a label on a cardboard tag that we had tied to the net, you know. I remember doing that for a customer in Bayswater, like, and thinking, oh, this is absolutely it. This was kind of like in 2009. This is the future. And we would be tying these labels on thinking, oh, at some point we'll find a way of doing this, you know, automatically. And they never paid us and they went bust.
Oh, no.
And it was just like, oh, wow, we spent like nights tying the labels onto the net and they didn't even create a very successful business. But then that changed with Ocado. Okay. And, you know, that's when things
new
started.
Learnings.
Yeah. And we'd learnt a lot. Or, well, me and no one else had learnt a lot, while me and a couple of drivers had learnt a lot in tying the label to the net, you know. And now, of course, it is automatic and it is faster. But there's still a lot of, you know, it's not fully automated. And that's what's quite nice about it as well. We've got really skilled guys in Holgood that are just super quick at packing stuff with that cotton net. You know, I've got a couple of packers, like we've got a lot of packers now, obviously, but I've got a couple of guys that have worked with me for years that have got Norby and Yanni, right? They're just like, they are machines, right? But there's just a joy in the pace. And there's almost an artistry about that, you know, like kind of in the, well,
we almost artisan.
We can't replace those guys because we don't want to put a machine where they are. We did buy a fully automated machine once and we named it after Yanni. We kind of like had it like this vinyl on it, like the Yanni 5000, you know. We spent a lot of money on that machine and we replaced it with Yanni.
The machine.
It just sometimes doesn't work.
So that's interesting. I've never heard that on. So you think there's a limit to automation? I guess if you've got very standardized stuff, you're going to go that way. But actually, you're never going to replace all of the jobs. And then you'll get, I guess the economic theory is that you get more new jobs. They might not be the same, but actually it's still going to create value. But what you're saying is that there's a little bit of a limit to what automation can do.
Well, there's a limit for us because we don't use plastic.
Right, okay.
The machines are created for plastic netting and they kind of sort of throw a product into the net, pull the net really tight, attach a label and let it go. The problem is when you stretch a home compostable fiber net. Because once you stretch it, it stays stretched. So it was just, you know.
And there's not enough of you to invent a new machine. Well, that's your next business, inventing the machines. No.
Yeah. My new machine will just be Yanni. How to multiply Yanni and Norby. If
train
they
them
agree,
up. Yeah.
Because they packed about 25% quicker than the machine. You know.
So that's, I guess, got to be one of your better ideas. What do you think are your best ideas, or even another one of your better ones? And also, you can contrast this with one of your worst. This is almost a best and a worst idea, because when it went to your Bayswater client, who then went bankrupt, you thought that's the worst idea.
Now
it's taken off its best, but I don't know.
Oh, I've had loads of bad ideas. Yeah. I've wasted so much money on bad ideas. But
you learned something from them.
Yeah, look, they were good things to do, but they wasted a fortune, okay? And then also sometimes the problem was my attention span.
Right.
So,
but this is what R&D sort of is, or experimentation. I mean, you might not call it a new type of bag, I guess, is not what you would think of as traditional R&D, like tech style. But it's an innovation, it's a new way of doing things, and it could work and it might not work.
Yeah, so the one of my big ideas in Holgood, because obviously we do also sell branded product and we sell sort of more sustainable type foods and snacks, right? Before coconut water was a thing, okay, I was absolutely obsessed with importing, bottling, and selling fresh coconut water, and not selling anything in a Tetra Pak or so. I found someone that could supply me frozen coconut water from Thailand. It had to be organic, so I then paid to have it certified by the Soil Association in Thailand. And then I brought containers of frozen coconut water over, and we had a high care facility in our first Greenford warehouse. And then we would defrost it and bottle it, and then we would put it through HPP process, which would extend the shelf life, but it would mean that it wasn't heat pasteurized. And to make money out of that, we had to sell it for £13 a litre.
Wow.
But
did it sell?
Well, the only people that would stock it was Planet Organic. Yeah. And it did sell. You know, I don't know how much it sold. I mean, it was a long time ago, so I don't really remember any of it. All I remember is my new CFO at the time, Rob, sort of come in. And within a couple of months, he was like, okay, we need to talk about what makes money and what doesn't. The coconut water loses about 20 grand a container, so you might want to stop it. So we just didn't order anymore. But I really wanted to, you know, I just wanted to try it, and I thought it would work. But the problem is that by the time we were bottling it and the label, and I just got bored.
Mm. Well, a really good CFO, if you had one at the time, could have just looked at that and gone, well, could work. You're going to need a million people to buy your coconut water.
Rob definitely kind of said, you just got to sell a lot more. But obviously, there was in the early days of Holgood, there was this want to do a bit of everything.
Yeah.
You know, so, okay, we'll do coconut water, we'll do hummus, we'll do, you know, and actually, and then, you know, we built we spent almost £500,000 building a high care facility so that we could sell prepared organic vegetables. We would sell tons and tons of spiralized courgette every week when that was a thing, you know.
Has that stopped being a thing?
I think it is stopped being a thing because nobody makes it.
Right.
we could have been the biggest spiralizing company in the world, but everybody got really bored of it. I mean, you know, we had kind of like stainless steel industrial drills with these little attachments on the end where we would just spiralize courgette all day.
Oh, you've invented some brilliant stuff. It reminds me of I was in Kyoto many years ago traveling, and I met, supposedly he told me he was the last person to make wooden buckets by hand. I bought one, I remember, and it cost something like £100 for a wooden bucket in yen. It was costing like £5 in wood now and £2 in plastic, but it was beautifully made. But I was just like, no one can tell the difference in the stuff, and you have made it by hand.
Yeah, he had a room full of buckets, machine made buckets, and he would wait for people like you to come along. Yeah.
Maybe that was it.
Yeah, that was definitely it. But yeah, so I've had loads of bad ideas, and you know, and in many respects, the most important thing about having bad ideas, the same as having a bad month or a bad week in business, is you just got to look forward.
Yeah.
The most important thing is that you just keep on moving forward, and you try not to reflect too much on all the mistakes that you've made, and you just keep on looking towards what it is that you're ultimately aiming to do.
And so that's the other thing which I reflect on. You mentioned sort of the people culture piece, the purpose piece, management, and then the looking forward and the learning from mistakes. And the thing which seems to loop all of that together is essentially what I might call mental strength or resilience or mental health, whatever you want to do. That the mindset which allows you to keep going, even though you might have spent £20,000 on coconut water and things are going wrong, and then also still invent new stuff, have new ideas, bring new things on, and continue to grow. And I think over time, as I've seen businesses, that actually people in business or actually in all walks of life, that element, that mindset, call it, and the ability to recover from that or not, seems to be a really differentiating factor of how well people in businesses do. And would you say that's a unifying thing, or is there something else you'd point to?
So for me, it was always a challenge of there was never much balance, and I think that it's when you're working really, really hard, it's very difficult to almost sort of, I don't know how people are able to work really hard without affecting themselves really negatively mentally. And I don't think that I was set up. I didn't have the tools to cope. Definitely not. So for me, just working flat out was also a big distraction as well from my mental health, because it just deteriorated and got worse and worse as I worked harder and harder and harder.
And so you just had to discover those tools along the way as well.
Yeah, I don't think I've got those tools yet.
Yeah,
but I definitely, you know,
you're better.
Yeah. Look, it's different now, and there are and you know, when I started the business, I didn't have kids, and now I've got three. So, you know, you pretty quickly get your shit together when you've got children, you know, and definitely, you know, for me, I didn't. Yeah, I wasn't. I just did not have the coping mechanisms. So I just drunk, you know, and then eventually you get to a point where you're kind of like, well, this definitely isn't working, because that takes you to a whole new level of low. And so actually things probably did improve when I stopped, you know, I stopped drinking 6 years ago, and being completely sober for the past 6 years definitely allows you to then learn other ways to cope that are maybe a bit more beneficial, like exercise.
Is that the time the line of kombuchas came in?
What, when I stopped drinking?
Yeah, we need a good drink alternative.
No, do you know what? We sell lots of drinks at Whole Good, right? But I just drink water now.
Yeah.
It's just so boring. But it's just because I can never believe. I'm always a bit cynical. Apart from a few kombuchas. There's this LA brewery one. This hops one.
Yeah. I haven't had the hops one.
Oh, it's in a bottle, and I like it because it's ambient, so I don't have to remember to always keep it in the fridge. But like, it's just genius because there's a kind of the hops thing. You know, there's some kind of memory there of beer,
yeah, something,
right? But it's not alcohol, isn't it?
I tried a non-alcoholic gin the other day. It was actually pretty okay, and also a non-alcoholic Negroni, which was also pretty okay. So they're getting there.
Yeah, but for me, I don't know. It's a bit like the whole meat-free thing. I don't know if I'm not going to eat a sausage.
Yeah.
I don't know if I need to replace it with something a different kind of sausage. I'd probably just rather eat more veg. And that's where I get really, for me, with all of the different drinks, it just explodes my mind a bit. So I just default to
water. Tap water.
Yeah, well, or fizzy water, like, you know, carbonated water for me is
oh, I love tap water. London taps me. But I had this the other day. I ate this vegan hot dog and it was really tasty, but I was thinking, you know what, this is so tasty, this is not good for me either. This is as bad as a normal hot dog. Yeah. If I want to be healthy, I should be eating a salad or something.
Look, there's no doubt that, you know, if it's helping people to go more plant-based, and it means that there is the supply chain is more efficient, then okay, it's a good thing. But I would still, you know, for me, I would just be a bit more purist about it. And, you know, obviously for Whole Good, people should just eat more fish.
So what do you think people most underestimate or misunderstand then around running a business? So you underestimated the management time, particularly starting up. Do you think, because I speak to people and I get the sense they really don't know what it's like to run a business at all. And I guess it's strange because everyone works in these, but most people, I guess, are working either in big business or they've got a very specific role in a business and they don't realize this overarching thing about what it takes to run one.
I don't think it's that important to know before you do it. What is important is to be able to adapt and change. Because, you know, when we started Holegood, you know, the first year was like, you know, we turned over like £250,000, you know. You just don't need to know what you need to know when you're running a £30 million business. So, and I'm sure that will change in the future.
And it would have got in the way, actually. Probably.
Well, yeah, definitely. Yeah, we wouldn't have bothered, right? But the key is to just make sure that you are able to adapt and change and remain open to those changes. Because it's going to be very different every year. The biggest struggle, one of the biggest challenges, especially growing a bit, I always sort of, like, you know, growing a business as slowly as I've grown mine, right? You know, kind of, okay, we're in a good place now and the growth is actually...
It still averages £2 million a year on revenue now from 2007
That's true. So maybe that's okay, but
pretty good.
But you know, obviously now the jumps are happening a lot quicker, and we're engineered for that now. But yeah, it's that constant ability to change, and one of the difficulties for me, even as we employed more managers, it's quite easy to outgrow them quite quickly, because somebody that's coming in to run an £8 million business is probably pretty different to someone coming in to run a £30 million business. You know, my current CEO would have laughed if we had offered him a position in an £8 million or £6 million business, because it's probably just not right for their skill set. It's just not big enough.
Yeah, actually, this is a really interesting thing you see with companies, and then as you go bigger, that there is a time for CEOs to jump off. And sometimes, well, like Elon Musk, he seemed to have gone all the way to like a trillion. But it's actually very rare to have someone who's good at small to large, because, like you say, the skill sets change. Some people change with it and have what it takes. But I actually think maybe most don't, and also most fool themselves, and it might fool themselves either way. So I've seen people from big business think they can go and do a startup, and in some ways they have some of the skills, but in other ways they have to unlearn a lot of things, or they do things which the business is not ready for, and then it falls flat on its face.
I definitely think that must be so much harder when people, or they raise the right amount of money and it's a brand and they're able to get that scale into the brand. For me, it was completely different because I was building my own supply chain, ultimately. And for me, definitely, you know, 30 million is where I'm at. I'm off. I am not the CEO.
But you're still growing the business.
So I'm in charge of the growth now, right? Which is that's kind of been what I've always been in charge of, and then by default I've also been CEO, so I've had to look inward and try to control it. But once it gets to this size, you've got to have someone skills. That really knows what they're doing. You've got to have someone constantly looking inward, because if I'm looking outward and growing the business and looking for new opportunity, which is everywhere at the moment, you just can't do both. And so actually having somebody that's really good at the mechanics is just a blessing, you know. So I think it's just so difficult to get the timing right. You know, for me, it's come at a time because while I acknowledge that there is so much growth in Holegood, we've expanded into enough warehousing now to more than double the business. So we're in that. We're in it. It's fitted out. It's all running at 4 degrees. And we just got to fill it with product, right? But while we're filling it with product, we really need to not drop the ball operationally. So that is absolutely the right time for me. It's also the right time for me because I'm older, you know, like I want to enjoy my work a little bit more, and I enjoy growing things, but I don't, and I love employing the people that we employ, but I don't necessarily want to look into that all the time.
Yeah.
Because it's exhausting. And it's exhausting, especially when you've gone through so many different highs and lows of growing a business from small to medium. You definitely don't want to, there's definitely cupboards that you're almost scared of opening because historically you haven't liked what's fallen out. What's great when you've got someone new coming in is that they're just going to walk in and open all the cupboards and nothing's going to trigger them when they open them. Oh, okay. Yeah. There's a dead body or there's a problem. That's fine. I'll deal with it.
Yeah. Whereas that's my job now.
That's my job.
And
I love it. Yeah. You know, whereas for me, I would just be like, okay, I'm going to keep all of those cupboards locked and just look forward.
Yeah. Because growing's my thing.
Yeah. Because growing is my thing. Whereas actually, you know, you've just got to, it must be so difficult for different founders to know when to step aside in an operational way. But yeah, for me, it's been so easy.
Cast lies together. Well, that makes me reflect partly because of what's happening over the last couple of years, maybe on your insights into what's happening with supply chain and maybe some thinking about, is there something you think this country could do better? And maybe that could roll into the thought of, you know, is there something that government could do? Because I have a sense, I don't follow politics that much, but government hasn't really done that much for small business.
They've done nothing.
And supply chain still seems to be a mess. So it'd be interesting to your view on what's happening and what would you do? What could you do?
One of the biggest issues, okay, like, we're a food business, right? So supply chains are different for all different types of business. But if you just take the supply chain in food, there is no doubt that, and this is almost why I wanted to have my own supply chain and not try to outsource everything. It's constantly been undervalued. The supply chain is constantly undervalued. Even now, if we're speaking to a customer that might have multiple stores, they'll want to understand why the price is the price. And it's almost like the wheels that get it there is magic. But even if you look back to the grower supplying into us, there has never been an acknowledgement of how much it costs to deliver and who is delivering it. You know, like the lorry guy that is doing it. The lorry driver that is delivering the goods has chosen to, you know, be a delivery driver, but then realize that there is zero out there for them in terms of resource, in terms of stopping and having a shower or having, you know, these guys are traveling for days and no one gives a shit about how they live, right? So it's been so undervalued that obviously once COVID hit and also people were beginning to reflect on their own lives, who would want to go in a lorry and drive the way that they had to? So there's no investment. If you wanted to attract people to drive lorries and to take that as a career, which is a really respectful career, why isn't there the investment in, like, why are you, if you go into a service station, I live out of London now, and I have done for the past few months. And sometimes I'll pop into the services on my way out of London. And in the evening, like, the lorry park is completely full and there are lorries kind of tailing up, you know, into the lorry park. You know, like, so there's no way that they're all going to get a shower or they're all going to, you know, it's really, really difficult. So the whole thing from the rates that we pay for transport, you know, and Holgood would have been guilty of it. We would have always been looking at trying to drive the prices of transport into us down. But
that
now,
comes from the customer.
But the problem is that it comes from this place of, we have this really false economics around food, where food has just been sold too cheaply for too long. And now where it feels like at the moment with inflation where it is and post the pandemic, maybe there is this, you know, that the opportunity is now sort of almost passing, because as inflation becomes like towards double digits, actually now it's going to be difficult to correct anything because everything's just going to get really expensive. But hopefully once that levels out, it won't then be a race back down to the bottom, because it's definitely the supermarkets that drive that, because that is the biggest economic factor in a lot of food in the UK, is that people are expecting prices where there are extremely thin or no margins or negative margins. And then that puts a pressure on the independent market because people have this false sense of what things are worth. Mm. I mean, I can never believe like how cheap a banana is, you know? Like what happened in that supply chain for this banana to still be so cheap? You know, we really undervalue all of that. And that's shown also in the food waste that we create as well. We just do not value the picking or the growing, the picking, the energy in shipping, and the person that ultimately delivers it to you. What a phenomenal amount of energy to go into something that is then pre-packed and thrown in a bin.
Yeah, I definitely get that from my mum and even before my godmum and things, that you don't waste that food because it was such a larger part of what you spent your income in. You just would have to be very, very, very not clever to be wasting that. And then, like you say, because you think it's only 50p or 20p, or you don't even think about it, we waste it. I was intrigued, though, when things are essentially were saying, if you want to attract lorry drivers, we would need to make the career seem good, and we would actually need to put in services and things so that their career could be good. And there's other bits in the supply chain would be that. And I don't see any policy doing that. And I guess I'd be a little bit unhopeful that that would happen. So we had probably the most stressful time in the last 2 years that we've had, arguably for a generation. And I don't see those conditions getting better. Do you see something more hopeful there, or is it going to take something else? But what more could it take? You know, if the supply chain had cracked through the pandemic, people would have starved. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's really hard, isn't it? Because obviously, you know, we're not lorry drivers, and we don't know. There might be some places that are better than others, but there's no doubt that more money is being spent on transport, and drivers are getting paid more. But again, you just worry about when does that get reversed out, or when does that start to get replaced with technology? There's obviously more economical ways of transporting things that you could imagine in the future. But while there's people in lorries, you would hope that it's going to get a bit better for them.
Yeah. And then anything else? Because people talk about regulation. Is there too much health and safety? Is there not enough? And I guess the other aspect is, which we touched on a little bit, is access to capital. I mean, I really don't see, this is something I have, like, the government says, oh, we're funding this and that. I don't really see it flowing to small businesses a lot. Banks are gatekeepers and not terribly helpful. And yeah, I'm not sure whether the regulations made it easier for small business, where I guess the problem is you need to have good faith actors, right? So if you have bad faith small business, yes, and regulations obviously stop bad faith happening. That's their point. But it really seems to hamper good faith businesses. I don't know if you have a view.
And also the challenge is where you know, if there's capital available, you know, where'd you spend it in terms of, like, you know, if you're trying to make something more sustainable or better, you're still very dependent on what's around you. You know, even if there was a huge amount of money to spend and invest into electric vehicles just for a cleaner environment and better driving experience for the driver, you know, we are looking at these beautiful electric trucks, right? Great for the driver. Great driving position, lower to the curb, so less impact in terms of getting in and out of the vehicle. Just a better experience. but they're 330 grand, you know. and if you invest in that, I mean, we're lucky. It's a company called Volta, and they're doing this great kind of truck as a service. It's kind of like contract hire, really, but you know, like a monthly fee for this electric truck, right? Which makes it more affordable. But then there's infrastructure challenges. You know, where are we going to charge it? You know, you even like we've all got electric cars, obviously, at Holgood, and we're very lucky to have, you know, 25,000 square foot of solar kind of powering a fair amount of the warehouse, not as much as we would like. But, you know, when you charge your car in London, the charging bay is only big enough for a car. Mm. How are our 26 ton or 18 ton electric trucks going to pull over and charge halfway through a journey? So even that doesn't look, you know, there's now chargers for taxis that are exclusively for taxis. Great. But where are we going to charge? You know, we're hopefully running a trial in the autumn where we will run one Volta truck for a month. Where are we going to charge it? You know, and even just in terms of, you know, where our we've got five warehouses all on the same estate in Greenford. Mm. There is not enough power in any of them to get a really juicy charger. So, you know, there's always going to be some kind of energy deficit in our fleet.
Yeah.
Because just the infrastructure cannot cope.
It's not there. Someone told me the answer was going to be in lampposts.
Lampposts for cars, but, you know, that,
not
going to
help the
chargers. No, we need to get so much charge into... I mean, they do that in Westminster where you can plug into a lamppost. Yeah. But, you know, it's only going to get you... It's going to get you to the shops.
Yeah.
And you don't need the shops because Gorillas or Getir can deliver it to you on an electric bike.
Yeah, electric vehicle. It's much better. Okay. Well, I thought maybe we do a little small section of underrated, overrated. So I'll give you two or three things.
All right.
And you can... Or you can sort of pass or make some sort of comment.
I mean, everything... is underrated and overrated in my opinion. But yeah,
we'll see. We can see why. So underrated, overrated comment is like plastic bag tax.
Underrated. I think it's been brilliant.
Oh, you think? There you go. Look, we found something.
Yeah.
Because that.
Although I do find myself carrying
so much stuff.
About 30 items out of a shop.
Yeah.
To not use that bag.
Yeah, no,
or not pay the 20p for it.
Has done what it's done. Actually,
it's been successful.
Was unusual for it.
But what did the plastic bag manufacturing guys do? Like, what did they see it coming? Are they now making, you know, what did have they all gone bust? Have they made something else? I'd like to know the story.
Yeah, you know what? I don't think it was ever a really big part of their business. And actually, someone's told me it's also like if you think about plastics in general, both straws and bags. So tiny, like 0.1, not even. So it's a little bit of a like, it's a signaling thing. Like it's useful to sort of do, but actually, that's not where your main plastics trouble is.
Okay,
so I don't think
the dude that was making plastic straws didn't have to quickly start making paper straws.
Yeah,
they just focused on the other plastics.
But yeah, the 99.9% of what they actually do.
I feel far less.
Minimum wages. Underrated, overrated, or any comment?
Minimum wages. Well, hang on. I don't know what...
So minimum wage legislation and the minimum wage or the living wage of where we are now. They are good thing, underrated,
yeah, great
overrated.
Thing.
Yeah.
I mean, we've really struggled to pay it. I've got to be honest about that.
Well, is that... Then that's a bad thing for business.
Well, no,
not?
Okay. But it's so right. You always... It's very hard... And it's very important to not think in business that it's so easy to think, oh, there's always another thing coming. Like, you know, the NI rise in April. You're like, oh, God, here's another cost, right? Because obviously there have been a lot. But there's no doubt that it's expensive to live in London. I've moved out of London because it's so expensive. So if we want people to live near our warehouse and work for us, we have to endeavour to pay them
a living wage.
Yeah. So I think it's great.
Although I guess the people who think it's not good would sort of argue, well, if you've got a thin margin business, which wouldn't exist, so all of those jobs would go because it would exist on, I don't actually even know quite what the numbers are, but it would exist on £8 to £10, but could not exist on £10 to £12.
Sure, but at that point, I think that it would only be fair for them to argue that if they showed what they were on and their top tier management were on.
Okay, so yeah, so that would, so yeah.
It becomes very grey, doesn't it? You know, if the margin is that thin and it puts you under that level of duress, something's got to give. You know, you're going to have to increase your margins because otherwise, essentially, you are saying that, you know, you're driving towards that idea that, you know, we get things made overseas because it's essentially, you know, labour that is not paid enough. And it's practically slave labor. So there has to be some sort of moral ground eventually, doesn't there, where you just sort of say that is just not enough.
Yeah. I think pure libertarians do go that. So that's their argument. But like you say, there is.
But, but it is tough, you know, and it has all of that has been tough, especially, you know, during the pandemic as well.
Well, I also sometimes say I look at it in cafe businesses that sometimes they maybe should just be a social enterprise, right? That not every enterprise needs to make huge amounts of profit to exist. So if you pay a living wage, you wash your face, maybe there's a little bit of excess
like
to keep.
Like Change Please.
Yeah.
You do the coffee and various other stuff. You know, that is a great way of, you know, the people that they employ and the way that they're not for profit. You know, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Okay. Underrated, overrated, fear of failure, or fear in general.
I just don't know what the right answer. so overrated would be in fear of a failure. Well, I can't.
Good thing or bad thing.
Don't be scared of failure.
Yeah,
so
or should
underrated
you?
Underrated or overrated?
Yeah, being scared of failure is that.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying don't be. So is that?
So don't
that,
be.
Is yeah, that so overrated or underrated?
So fear of failure would definitely be overrated then.
Yeah. Yeah. Overrated.
Yeah.
Don't be scared.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because ultimately, what you know, you're just going to go bust.
Mm. Right. Yeah.
No, but how bad can it get? You know, if you fail in business, nobody shoots you, unless you've borrowed money from the wrong people.
Then you've had so many other problems.
Yeah. Then actually, that's just the least of your worries. Yeah. So, no, I just don't think, you know. I have been scared of failure. It does scare me, but it has taken some pretty big crisis, you know, one of them being this year, for me to stare into that failure and look over the edge and kind of go,
that's okay.
It's okay. It's going to be okay.
Yeah.
It's going to be okay. And so it you mustn't let that fear stop you, even though that fear can paralyze you so much sometimes.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay, and then last one on this one would be class, or I guess particularly working class. Do you think not rated enough, or to kind of like people use it as a kind of symbol and status and it's not really a thing?
Overrated.
Overrated.
So I think one of the great things about being an actor is when you're an actor, it's kind of classless, right? Mm. So I come from
You can pretend to be whatever you
just
want.
Be whatever you want. Yeah. No, but you know, you always saw, you know, actors marrying politicians, or,
yeah,
you know, they're this complete kind of just operates in a, you know, you're able to just sail through any class and mingle with any person. People are always interested in you, often interested in you being an actor. So, you know, I come from a very working class background, and class has not held me back. Maybe being an actor helped that, but it certainly shouldn't hold you back.
Mm.
And in fact, if anything, you know, within Holgood, it's been really important to always ensure that everybody that we're employing, and now that there are 160 of us and it's climbing, actually then you get to really be able to look at what an incredible sort of mix of people you're able to employ and reflect your local environment and reflect what London really looks like, you know, and make it classless and endeavour to make sure that you are employing the right mix of people to ensure that you don't just have this snotty upper middle class management, right?
Yeah.
This historical idea of, you know, really, really, you know, I've got no qualifications, I have no GCSEs, but I was an actor, and so maybe I pretended I knew how to run a business, right? And many people would probably say at work that I still am pretending that I know how to run a business. But you are able to just, you know, ensure that you've got a team that reflects your local surroundings and not be obsessed with qualification and class, right?
Yeah.
Because you know, we don't need a load of people with, I mean, I don't know what my current CEO's qualifications are, because that's not how I made the decision to employ him.
Yeah, and I think it works both ways, because I do some outreach and speak to a lot of young people over the year, and some people go, oh, you know, that whatever it is, X, Y, and Z isn't for me. And I'm kind of like, why would you think that?
How would you know?
Whether that's going to what you would consider a fancy university or not, or whether it's starting a business. Like, I'm actually, doesn't really matter. If you have that ambition and you think that might be you should do it, and don't let,
yeah,
you know, middle class, upper class, whatever you call it, they tend to think, oh, well, we could just go and do it. Working class, we go that. I think you should have the same attitude, because it's correct on that.
Yeah, but also then also as an employer, you don't have to hang on to people needing those qualifications.
Exactly.
You know, I remember seeing a job ad for Holgood, like I saw it online, and it said, or like you know, on LinkedIn or wherever. And it mentioned that you needed a degree in something. And I remember thinking, well, shit, I mean, like, I don't have a degree. I don't have a GCSE.
I wouldn't employ myself.
Yeah. Like, how can we discriminate against me? How can we discriminate against people like this? So, I mean, I hope it's been removed. But I remember I asked for it to be removed, because I just thought it was a bit silly. You know, I just don't understand how a degree is going to make you good at a specific... If I came into this business not knowing anything, right, and I own it and I've managed to get to this point, there's no guarantees for the future, but we've got this far, right? I just think that we need to talk to people, understand what they can do, and then see if we can get them in the business.
Yeah.
And then make sure that we pay them enough so that they don't leave, and tune their skills into something that fits Holgood. And that is what is really important for me in terms of how do you create something truly sustainable. It kind of should be classless. It should be paid well. And you need to look after people, right? Yeah. And it took me at least 10 years to realize that, because I just wanted everybody to work like me and not complain too much. If I didn't complain, why would they complain? Whereas that was just the wrong way of looking at it.
And do you think you have any tips or insights into how to hire good people or be with good people? No one's cracked this, by the way. So if you do, this is your next business.
For me, it's always been really difficult. And I've always been a bit too emotional about it. But I have only ever trusted my instincts.
Okay.
But I would say that that's been good and bad in equal measure so far. Other than, I would say it's much easier to make senior hires around coffee chat.
Yeah.
Than it is maybe someone that's going to pack in the warehouse, because that you know, there are maybe certain skills that you've got to be showing, you know.
Yeah.
But it has definitely been one of my biggest challenges. But it's also really challenging when the business is growing fast.
Mm, different type of people.
Because you just constantly, you know, there are these terrible moments where you kind of look at it and think, oh no, we've outgrown them, you know? And that's absolutely fine, but it's really not going to work anymore. And also equally, one thing I would definitely say about employing people is do not do not just constantly promote within your business just because someone's been there for a long time.
Yeah,
right.
Time based.
It just doesn't mean like the guy that like that. Like, I hate to do this publicly, but let's use Norby as an example, right?
You need to give them a pseudonym.
Right, okay. John.
Employee X, right? Yeah.
John.
Yeah.
Okay, not Norby.
Yeah.
Okay. Fastest packer in the West. Phenomenal supervisor. I don't know if Norby's the next CEO, though.
Yeah.
Right? But just if he stays there for the next 10 years, I don't know if he's ever going to be the CEO.
But also that... Okay, so there is some, because CEO's got to do a lot of stuff. But you should be able to be satisfied being the fastest packer in the West and have a good career.
Yeah, and Norby's a supervisor as well, you know. So like, definitely, and you know, I'm Johnny.
John, yeah. Right?
I'm sure that you know that, yeah, you know, he's paid handsomely for being the fastest packer. I'm sure, right? But yeah, definitely like that. We did way too much. Kind of, let's just promote.
He's been here for 6 months.
Okay, now they're in charge of the warehouse, and then they start failing.
Yeah,
and it, you know, it's your own fault when you do that. You just think, shit, we've completely messed it up for them because we over promoted. And once you've done that, it's so hard to go back, especially for the individual as well. So you just the relationship just implodes. Mm.
So this is an insight that actually a lot of law firms have not quite. Have not quite done. I think one of the last ones have just removed it. You only get promoted in law firms traditionally by time, and it means your great young lawyers leave because they can't afford to wait because they've got better than where their position is, and what you get left with is often not what you want.
Yeah, just tired and
that. Okay, so final couple of questions. Hopes and dreams for Holgood or your next chapter? Oh. 30 million must go to 60 million. Why not 100? That sort of thing.
Look, but 60 million is right in front of us. We have the infrastructure to do about 65 million now. So that is just sitting there.
And still be sustainable in all of that. So you've kind of made a difference, really.
Definitely move. You know, the focus will definitely be once we trial the electric vehicles and we start to look at. My fear is that we can't really get heavily into electric fleet and more sustainable fleet until we get out of all of the warehouses that we're in now.
Yeah, that
where we've just got more energy going into.
Can heating and cooling be decarbonized? That's quite a tricky one.
It's difficult if it's not already within your built within your infrastructure, right? So, like, we would have to go. We will have to think really carefully, and that's why it's great to have a CEO that can be that strategic as well, is that be able to speak about what we want and how we want to do it, and they can go off and start to plan that for 3 or 4 years, you know. But yeah, so the hopes and dreams for Holgood would be to continue growing the way that we have done, probably a bit quicker now because we're ready for it, and making sure that we take most of the people on the journey with us now. I think that now that I've got a bit more time to think about the business and think about what we've achieved, I want to make sure that we absolutely resource it properly. We don't, you know, during the COVID, because it just by default, it was the same for everybody, right? So, we really wrung ourselves out. You know, it was really hard to work for, obviously not as hard for sort of frontline services, but like it was really difficult, and people had lots of real personal strain. I hope that we can do the next 30 million by being a bit kinder, a bit nicer, and really take people on that journey with us and not leave people on the platform as the train leaves the station. I would like it to continue being as inclusive as we've managed to make it now. I really want to propel that forward. And I think that is one of the most important drivers for me, whereas it used to be profit. Mm. And I'm really grateful that it's not profit anymore, actually, because this is so much bigger than that in terms of we are able to start to create opportunity and career paths for people. I never realized how important that would be for me.
But profit, I think, will be a very strong side effect of that.
I bloody hope so. No, look,
It's one of those oblique things. Actually, you say that about the irony is you once said that about so-called shareholder value. You can't actually make it go up 10% in a month, but you can work on, say, products that people want and things to buy. And actually, it's the same for happiness. You can't really say, oh, I'm going to be 10% happier tomorrow, but you can do things like eat well, do exercise, yeah, be with your friends.
Absolutely, absolutely. My CFO, Rob, right, would always be saying like that my entire life was linked to our monthly P&L, you know? He would just be like, you just can't live month to month like that, you know? And actually, obviously we haven't done that for some time, but like, you know, it really is that element of that you just have to have a really long-term vision and goal of being able to continue to scale the business in a sustainable, creative way that has enough money in it to win and succeed, right? Easier said than done sometimes. But you have to look at the local benefits and the staff benefits and the benefits that you are creating for those staff and the families of those staff. Otherwise, that is just not true sustainability.
Mm.
If you're putting something in a cotton net, but you're shouting and, you know, paying minimum wage to the people doing it, or below minimum wage, you know, that's not what success looks like either.
I think a lot of people are starting to call that stakeholder capitalism, or at least looking to grow the pie of all of your various elements. Okay, last question then. Do you have any thoughts on advice, life advice or entrepreneur advice that you'd like to share from your journey so far?
Yeah, do not put your business first. Ever. Do not put your business first. I used to put my business first. It made me so sick. It made me so ill. And I think that if you can, you've just got to be, you do have to work really hard. But I worked like an idiot, you know? I worked like a hard idiot. And I think that you have to, look, it kind of feels so old fashioned and different because it's just changed so much now, right? I can remember being in my warehouse and thinking, oh, I'm just never going to be able to speak to anybody about my mental health because they'll think my business is a failure. Whereas now, you know, people are completely geared up to look after their staff and to look after people's mental health. You couldn't even say the phrase mental health without being worried that an investor or a new customer might judge you too harshly for it. So I guess it's different now because it definitely pushed me into a tunnel of being secretly unwell while trying to expand this business. So do not put your business first and ensure that if you stop believing in what you're doing and it's also not making money, right? Do something else. Yeah. You know, yeah. Don't be afraid of doing something else. And that is so important. We've been really lucky that we haven't had to do that. But I definitely feel like in the moments when I've had to think about that, because there have been some, that you suddenly think, no, there will be other opportunity. It's so easy to become blinkered with your single vision of what success or your current success looks like, that you stop forgetting that there will be other successes. You can get up and you can carry on. You have to be brave. And you have to be able to not get lost in the idea that you're currently in.
Yeah.
Step back or step out and do something else. Don't be an idiot.
It's not all going to be iced coconut water.
Yeah, exactly. if you're fresh, unpasteurized coconut water business does not work, don't worry.
Well, don't worry. There will be other things. Well, Carl, thank you very much. Whole Good, can get your products, Ocado, everywhere.
Oh, yeah, Ocado, Getir, like Milk and More, kind of everywhere, yeah. And And obviously, I would say that, yeah, everyone in the UK can find our product somewhere. You just got to look for it.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
If you appreciate the show, please like and subscribe, as it helps others find the podcast.